Good morning. My name is Larry Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm free this morning. And I really mean I'm free. Iceland. Wow. Guess you heard the story. I'm wearing four-day-old clothes. There are things living on me that didn't come to Iceland with me. But I'm very happy. Chris did a great lead-in on the information that Sam and I are going to present to you. Did a great job in step one. And I'm going to be a bit redundant with some of that information leading into two and three. I have a partner back in the States named Christian, and we tour around the country, the world, presenting the Joe and Charlie style book study. And our home group is called We Are Not a Glum Lot. We meet on Thursday nights in Atlanta. And it is a Joe and Charlie style book study. At the beginning of each one of those studies, we do a thing called the alcoholic puzzle. And I want to do a little lead-in with that. And then we'll move on, if I can get this mic out. Very cool. Chris alluded to a lot of this information, but this puzzle, I need graphics. I don't know about you, but if I can see it, if I can read it, if I can touch your experience, then I'm going to be better adept at the information. Thanks, Mark. The first part of this puzzle is the problem. That's why we're all here. This is what Chris told us about earlier this morning. This problem is broken into two parts. The first part of this problem is the obsession of the mind, and I'm a real big word merchant. If you look up the word obsession in the dictionary, it'll tell you that it's a thought that overrides all other thoughts. It's basically insanity. I've got a great life back home. I love to ride motorcycles. I love my dogs. I got a great little business, a cute little house on the lake. Lots of great friends. But once this obsession to drink alcohol, it becomes fully established in my mind, it overrules all other thoughts. Obsession, it's a thought that overrules all other thoughts. I don't think about you. I don't think about my bikes. I don't think about my business. I think about one thing, and it's drinking. And what happens is if I'm obsessing about a drink or a drug, I'm driving down the road, and we got these signs in our country that say, in front of a bar, let's say, the coldest beer in town. I'm done. You know, I'm in. I mean, that's the deal breaker right there. But what happens is once I pour this first drink into my body, it sets into motion the second component of this disease, and it's called the allergy of the body. Allergy, abnormal reaction to something. Anybody have an allergic reaction to anything here? What do you have? Lactose intolerant. So when you put something with lactose in it, what happens to you? Bad things. Your guts? Yeah? Anybody else? What do you have? What is it? Yeah? What happens? Yeah? Yeah? I have an allergic reaction to paper tape. If you put paper tape on my body in an injection site or a place where they've drawn blood, if you leave it on my body for 5 minutes and you pull it off, my skin comes off. Well, that puzzles nurses, medical practitioners. They don't get it. But that's what happens to me. It's an allergic reaction to something. And what happens to me as a real alcoholic, once I induce alcohol, the allergic reaction sets up and I can't stop drinking. My history tells me that I stop for two reasons. Either I get locked up, either in a spin dry somewhere, or I get locked up behind bars. Separates me from the drink. And the other reason that I would stop is if I die in the street. Now, there are some people that attend our meeting on Thursday night, and they say, well, I stop when I run out of money. Well, you didn't drink like I did, because if I run out of money, I'm going to take a brick bat or a tire iron, and I'm going to break the windows out of your car, your business, or your home, and I'm going to take what belongs to you and turn it into what I have to have. Not what I want, what I have to have to continue that run. You with me here? I don't have a choice as to when this is going to stop. I run until the bloody end, and money is not a sufficient reason to stop. Chris talked about the problem drinker and the hard drinker. There are several different types of drinkers. There's a social drinker. Back in our town, there's a little community called Dunwoody where the upper crust live. And I have this picture of a Dunwoody housewife sitting by the pool drinking a glass of Chablis and tipping it over and going, "Oops, I need to go to treatment." Well, that's a social drinker. But they've heard that treatment's a good idea for that. Then you got a problem drinker, and they may have a problem if, let's say, for instance, they're late for work a few times because they watched football a little too late, or they were making whoopee with the wife a little too long, or they just had one over the limit the night before, and they were late coming to work, and they get threatened in their job security. Problem drinker, they can cut back, they can moderate. Hard drinker looks an awful lot like an alcoholic, but given a sufficient reason, can stop. The difference between a problem hard drinker and me, the real alcoholic, is a good example is a hard drinker goes to court and he's been pulled over for driving while intoxicated. The judge says, "Mr. Smith, if I see you back in my courtroom again, driving while drinking, you're going to go to county for 90 days. This guy just stops. He stops drinking and driving an automobile. Now, I go to court for the same offense. Judge says, "Mr. Scott, I've got a citation here that says that you were over the legal limit drinking and operating a motor vehicle. If you come back in my court again with these circumstances, you're going to go to county for 90. Hell, I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail because I'm going. I mean, I'm going. I don't have a choice because I can't not drink. I can't not drink. Second part of the puzzle is the solution. Thank God. Solution is found in a spiritual nature, which we're going to get into. It's the only thing that we found since man started crushing grapes that will combat alcoholism, to arrest it. Where do I find the spiritual solution? Find it in the third part of the puzzle. Practical program of action, outlined in detail in the first 164 pages of that old ugly book we throw around. You with me here? So this is the alcoholic puzzle. We've identified the problem. Did that with Chris a while ago. And he asked those two questions that are found on the first page of chapter 4 in We Agnostics. You know? If when you honestly want to, and there's the caveat, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have a little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. That's me. Step 2 says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, which implicates that, you know, we're probably crazy, insane. The step doesn't say that we came to have faith. It says we came to believe. My experience is that I came to believe once I walked in your rooms and I followed you around and I watched you. I saw you, how you responded to life, not reacted. You laughed a lot. You drove your own car. You had a happy family. You had a good job. I wanted to know how I could acquire that, and you took me by the hand and you guided me down this path. But when I walked in the rooms, I had a brother, which you'll hear about tonight in my talk. My brother was older than me, and he had found you. And he's the one that did the 12-step work on me. And he put my hand in yours. But when I walked in the door the first time, I walked in with a hope that maybe, just maybe, you would have the answer to this thing that was killing me. So I walked in and I followed you around and I paid really, really close attention to you, because there was no door number three. I'm a dumpster diver like this guy. There's no insurance. There's no way to get into a detox. There was no path to that door. You were the last stop on the block. I hoped that through this regimen, I could find a way not to drink and die. Followed you around and I watched you. And I listened to some of the things you told me, and I followed some of the direction that you showed me. And I came to believe that maybe, just maybe, I too could achieve this. And then I did the work as you outlined for me early on. And all of a sudden, somewhere on that path, this faith popped up. It was a progression. I didn't walk in the door with faith. It's not what the book says. It says we came to believe. I have a young man that I'm sponsoring in Atlanta, and I've been around 22 years. Chris and I's sobriety dates are 30 days apart. I've worked with a legion of people. This young man popped up on the radar a little over 90 days ago. He's 22 years old, and I want to share my experience with this guy. His name's Hunter Dean, and he's just on fire. How you doing? No, I'm absolutely great. And I said, oh, God, this is going to be fun, because he doesn't have a problem. Everything's fine. Everything's great. Well, we're riding around. It's time to get into the work. And he's been through a dozen spin dries, jitter joints, and he just cannot not use. So I got him in my car. I don't sit in a room when I do the work. This is the way I do it. I get a guy in my car, and we drive. We drive, we talk, we read, we drive, we talk, we read, we stop, we pray, we drive, we talk, we read. We do the work. So we're riding around, and step one was real evident. I mean, 12 spin drives, come on, this guy's dying. He's powerless over alcohol and drugs. So I'm wondering why this guy gets to a certain point of this dryness and he can't not use. So I said, Hunter, tell me about your faith. And this glazed look came over his face. And I said, so, no faith. Well, my mom and dad's Christian upbringing, blah, blah, blah. And I said, this ain't about them. What do you believe? Well, and he had this glazed look. We're sitting at a red light, and on the right-hand side is a decorative stone wall going into an office complex. At the base of that wall is a beautiful flower bed full of pansies. Beautiful pansies, brilliant colors. But it had snowed and iced over big time in Atlanta. I mean, we had a really sucky winter in my state. But these little pansies are sitting there, and they got snow and ice all over them. And I said, Hunter, look at those pansies. He said, yeah, man, they're beautiful. I said, why don't we do this? Why don't you jump out of the car, take all your clothes off, just throw them in the back seat, and you run over and sit down with leaned up against that wall. It's about 3:00. I'll come back tomorrow about this time and pick you up. He says, what are you talking about? I said, just get out naked, lean up against the wall, sit down in the snow. I'll come back in 24 hours and get you. He says, well, I'll freeze to death. I said, really? I said, those pansies seem to be doing wonderfully. And he goes, wow. I said, would it be safe to assume that those pansies have a little more power than you right now? He said, well, hell yeah. I said, cool. We got something to work with. So we rode around and we talked a little bit more. And I told him, I said, you know, the downside of that pansy deal is if I got him in the car and asked us to drive us back home, you know, probably wouldn't work out too well. But they're doing wonderfully in the snow. I have a brother that owns an automobile store in Atlanta, and we were near that location at that time. And it was time to, I mean, we'd done one, we'd done two, and it was time to get into the work. And I said, we got to get on our knees, because that's how I take my guys through the third step prayer is on our knees. So we went into the car store and I asked my nephew, I said, is there a building, I mean, is there a room in this building that we could use for a few minutes that we could have privacy? He says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, we want to pray. Well, this guy used to run with me and he got sober another method. But anyway, he said, well, there's a business center down there. Just go down. If there's anybody there, run them out, lock the door. So Hunter's looking at me like, we're going to do what? So we go down there, and again, this guy's been around the fellowship long enough. He's got the vital information in this book memorized, but it's all knowledge. He's never applied any of it. So we get on our knees in this business center, and we took the third step prayer together. Now, the end of this story about Hunter is he's 98 days sober today. He's in the 12th step. He led a meeting last night at a treatment center that he went through. I got an email from him this morning. 98 days since he had a needle in his arm. And he goes, man, it's so cool to walk in that room and look into the eyes of the people that look just like I did 98 days ago. Now, that's power. Because today, he knows that he never, ever has to use again. He's free. I get these same looks at our home group. We have 150 to 175 people show up every Thursday night. And this is the page we're on. Get in here, get the work done, get free. And get out there and help other people. Now this guy lives in a sober living home in Atlanta. He was in his ninth step amends process. And the treatment center or the house said, oh, well, you don't have enough time to be out making amends. Well, as long as he's there and he's paying them this rent, his life belongs to them. So I said, well, make the amends you can now. And as time moves on, you can continue to make the amends. The book says, you know, that we became willing. It doesn't say that we went out and knocked them all out. So this guy's sitting on some amends, and it's okay. But he's doing the work. He's doing a tenth step. He's employing the 11th step in his life. And he's out helping others. Second step is nothing more than an observation. Coming to believe that there is something more powerful than me. And a conclusion of the mind that can restore me to sanity. Observation, conclusion of the mind. So, step two is pretty doggone simple. It's a strong suspicion, if nothing else. Most people, when they come into the rooms, they start thinking and they read the step that says, we came to have faith. No, it's not what it says. It says we came to believe. I take the message into treatment centers on a regular basis and I see that look. I had a chick stonewall me one day and she says, you're going to start talking about that God shit, aren't you? I said, yeah, we are. She says, well, I'm out of here. I said, whoa, hold it right there. I said, do you believe that I believe? She says, well, yeah, it's pretty obvious. I said, great, we got something to work with. Sit down. And, you know, you got to start somewhere. It's a suspicion. How arrogant to believe, and we've done it for years, walked around thinking that we were the most powerful things that ever took a breath. Seriously. We laugh, but it's true. You know, my brother called me up in September of 1987. He says, I understand you're dying. And if you don't get some help, we're going to bury you. And you know what I said? Now I'm homeless, using like a dog. And I said, oh, no, Bob, I'm good. I got this one. I'm dying. I got that ego going. Man, I can't let you know I'm living in a dumpster. There was a guy named Christopher Columbus back a little back, and he, you know, the book talks about this guy. It said that some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought of a round earth preposterous. And Chris was a neat guy. In this book study that we do, we've come to believe that Chris was probably an alcoholic. And there's some good evidence as to why we think that. Chris is maybe the only guy on the planet thinking that this planet is round instead of flat. But it was a strong suspicion. He had it was a theory. And he didn't have the means with which to prove his theory true. So being the good alcoholic he was, he went to the King of Spain. He said, "Hey, Ferdinand, how about hooking me up with some ships and some guys and some food? Let me prove my point." And Ferdinand says, "You're nuts. Get the hell out of my office." Well, being a good alcoholic he is, he went to the chick, you know, Queen Isabel. He says, "Hey, baby." You know how we are. Isabel's probably a good ally. She says, he says, "What can I do for you there, Chris?" She says, "Well, if you'll hook me up with some ships and some guys and some food, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to go to this brave new world, and I'm going to find these beautiful jewels and precious metals and furs and that, and I'll bring them back to you." She says, "You got it, dude." So she hooks him up with these three boats. Well, we believe he's alcoholic because the first thing he did is he hired a special sailor, because he's going over on a strong suspicion and a theory. And this special sailor's job was to get on the lead ship on the bow and hold a lantern. He told him, he says, "Man," he says, if we're cruising along and you see the edge of this sucker," he says, "you start hooping and hollering and waving this lantern, and we'll turn these boats around." Well, Chris's ass was real safe on the back boat, you see. He wasn't on that lead ship because he wasn't real sure about this idea. Well, we further think he's alcoholic because Chris believed you could sail west to get east. Pretty wacky. When he left, he had no idea where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he'd been. So Isabel says, "Hey, dude, where's my stuff?" He says, "Damn." He says, "I forgot it, Izzy." He says, "I tell you what, though. If you hook me up with some more boats and some guys and some food, I'll go back because I've seen the Brave New World. And there's much more abundance there than I originally thought." She says, "All right, but this time you better bring me my stuff." So this time, here's the difference. He left the first time on a strong suspicion, on a theory, on a belief. The second time, he went with complete faith because he had been there. He had the experience now. This time, there was no special sailor on that lead boat. Chris was up on the bow of that lead boat like, "I'm the man." And when he came back, well, when he got there, he knew where he was. He knew where he was going. When he got back, he knew where he had been. And he brought all those things to Isabel. Same thing happened with the Wright brothers. The book talks about them. These two guys were bicycle mechanics out of Ohio. Bicycle mechanics. And all these aeronautical engineers, all these physicists, had already proved that man could not fly. All these contraptions they built had failed. People had died trying to fly. Bicycle mechanics. They had a strong suspicion. They had a theory that they could string some wood and some fabric together and make this thing fly. Well, see, men's minds, our minds, are fettered by the things that we've been taught since we fell out of our mama's womb. Suspicion. So the Wright brothers call up the Charlotte Observer over in Charlotte, North Carolina, and said, "Hey guys, we're about to fly this thing over here at Kitty Hawk." So this reporter goes out to the beach, and these two bicycle mechanics get this contraption off the ground, and it flies. The reporter goes back to the publisher of the Charlotte Observer and says, "Dude, I saw this thing fly. These two guys actually, man flew at Kitty Hawk." Publisher says, "You're not putting that in my paper. Because if you do, society will read it. They'll come burn this joint down because man can't fly. The book talks about scientific proof is not always the best proof. Great example that we use there is the bumblebee. Back before computers and these high-tech programs, scientists and physicists used a slide rule. And years ago, they took the bumblebee. You got bumblebees here? Cool. They took the bumblebee and they put his little fat butt in that slide rule, and they did all the math on it, and it came back, and they said the bumblebee can't fly. They did. They said his body is too bulbous and his wings are too stubby, and this little critter can't fly. The problem with that theory is nobody told the bumblebee. And he just flies around and stings our ass any place, anytime he wants to. So that's the deal with it. It's a suspicion. It's a strong suspicion that maybe, just maybe, there is something greater than me that can restore me. Does that make sense to you? But we fight it. So we've come to believe. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of intellectual discussion. It's pretty simple math, actually. I'm powerless. I can't stop drinking. I'm living in a dumpster. And I'm thinking about putting a gun barrel in my mouth because I don't want to drink. But I can't continue to breathe and not drink. I no longer have a choice. But the only way I know to end it is to just off myself. And I didn't walk in here an atheist or an agnostic. I walked in believing that there was a power greater than me. I believed in God. But I had used up all my get-out-of-jail-free cards because I've been a pretty bad guy. I've hurt a lot of God's kids in my life, and I didn't deserve a second break. So we've blasted through this step two thing, step one and step two, and now it's time that we make a decision, and the third step says that we made a decision to surrender to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Alcoholics don't read that. Typical alcoholics read this. It says, we turned our will and our lives over to the care of God. No, you didn't. You made a decision. Probably 9 months ago, Chris was in our town, and he came to speak, and we're sitting there, and he says, let's go to Iceland. I said, okay, 9 months ago. So right then and there, sitting with Chris, I made a decision, and I'm going to come to Iceland and hang out with you guys. Now, that decision required some effort on my part. I needed to call the airlines. I needed to contact Arner and Samari, and I needed to do some stuff in order to get here today. Some of my stuff didn't make the same decision I did because it's, ain't funny, Samantha. Yeah, it's okay. So I had to do some stuff. So when you make this decision, it has to be followed with other stuff. You with me here? The step doesn't say that we turned anything over. It says we made a decision to. And the way that we turn that will and life over is by doing some stuff. And in doing that stuff, God shows up and the desire, the obsession is removed. It's gone. I don't know when it happened for me. Sometime between step three and step nine, it just was gone. There are two wills. We talked about turning our life and our will. Your life is your thoughts and wants. Your will is your actions. Make sense here? So there are two wills. There's God's will, which we believe to be pretty much divine. Have a hard time living in that all the time, but that's the goal. And then there's man's will. When God made us, these two-leggeds, we're the only creatures on the planet that have self-will, free will. We make decisions on what we're going to do or not do. We get ourselves in trouble. The two big ones for me is money and sex. Don't mess with my pocketbook and don't mess with her. because those are two things that just make me a little wacky. But animals are God-driven. Horses, cows, dogs, cats, fish. A little story I'll tell you about this animal thing. I'm sleepless one night, and I'm watching Discovery Channel or Animal Planet or whatever the hell it was. And when I turned the TV on, the camera was on this little still glassed over mirror kind of a pool in the upper levels of a mountain area. And it was just beautiful, a little mirrored lake kind of a thing. And all of a sudden, the camera goes below the waterline, and there are these big salmon. And they're swimming around in this pool. And all of a sudden, they zero in on the female, and she starts spitting out these little salmon babies. And they're swimming around in this pool. Little time lapse goes on, and these little babies get into the stream that's running down the side of the mountain during a spring thaw. And the water's running pretty good, and it's going over rocks and twisting, and it's crazy. But these little fish, the ones that make it, spill out into the ocean. And when they hit the ocean, they do this. And they swim out for thousands and thousands of miles. You ever been offshore in a boat? Anybody? When you're out there and you're outside the side of land, that little fear thing, that little fear meter starts going off. You're going, damn, I can't see land. How are they ever going to get us back? Well, they got a thing called Lorentz or a GPS, whatever. And they put the heading in, and they bring us right back to where we left. Well, these little fish don't have that. It's just them, man. They're naked. They're out there swimming around thousands of miles away. But when God made that little critter, he put a GPS, a little Garmin, inside them. He also put a little God clock in there. And at some point in their maturity, this God clock goes off. Ding, 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 ding. It's time to go mate. Little salmon sex. You know what I'm saying? And they turn their little salmon butts around, and they swim back to the mouth of this little creek from where they came. Thousands of miles. Because God said it's time to recreate. Now, getting back to the mouth of the creek ain't the big one. It's a spring thaw. These bears, these big grizzlies, they've been asleep all winter long. They're hungry. They just woke up, and they're hanging out on the rocks waiting for lunch to come by. Well, these salmon come back up in the mouth of that creek, and they start swimming up against this raging water, and they're skyrocketing over these rocks. And as they do, the bears are snagging them. Some of them will skyrocket and hit another rock and they die. But the ones that make it back to the pool from where they were born, they go back and they mate, they recreate, they do the same thing that their parents and their parents and their parents before them all did. And here's the kicker. After they have sex and give birth to the next generation, those two roll over and die. Whew. I'm going to do a lot of stuff for sex, but come on, that's a pretty stiff price. You know, come on, baby. So, turn your will, your thoughts and wants, and your life, your actions, over to a power greater than you. Sounds like a tall order, but you know what? My thoughts and wants have been pretty twisted. They ended me up in AA, you know? And my actions, for crying out loud. You know, I need something that has done a better job with this than me. So I show up in AA, and we've done step two. And we open the book to chapter five. We've done everything up to that point. And after we've read the three pertinent ideas, the very first paragraph after it says that God could and would if he were sought, it says being convinced. Do you ever wonder what that means? Being convinced of what? First two steps. That you're powerless over alcohol, that your life is unmanageable. That you've convinced that there is a power greater than you that can restore you to sanity. Now, if you're not there, you may not want to go forward. You may need to go back and revisit that work in the first two steps. Because I've had some guys that want to be the star pupil, and they'll say whatever they think it is that I want to hear. But I'm a pretty damn good judge because I'm a beat-down alcoholic. Chris alluded to it in that first step. I've qualified these guys. I'm convinced that they're a real alcoholic. Being convinced, we're at step three. And it says, which is we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that? What it really implies is I'm agreeing to do the rest of the work. That's all it is. It says, we made a decision to do the rest of the work is what that step really implies. But I can't do that work without a higher power's help, without God's help. I got to swallow some huge chunks of truth about myself. And then I got to sit down with some guy and share this information. I got some work to do, and I need God's help. I can't do this by myself. So, the book goes on and it talks about this actor, and it talks about the different relationships, the actor and the director, the employer and the employee, and the agent and the principal, and all the father and the son, father and the child. I get that. I need God in my corner to guide me through this work. And Sam's going to visit it in the next session. That fourth step, observations, writing, prayers, it's a series of that stuff, and I need God in my corner. So I've made this decision. And the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. That's step one. And it goes on to say, it talks about this actor and the director thing. And I've always wanted to run the show myself. I'm very strong-willed. Very strong-willed. And I don't know anything about how women think. I wish I did, but I don't. I'm a guy. I was raised in the South. I'm a good old boy. And I'm taught that I ain't supposed to cry. I ain't got to rely on nobody for nothing. And nothing could be further from the truth. Today I can cry. It's cleansing for me. It's healing. And I can actually practice humility. I tell you what, have all your belongings. Be in a weird country, a different country. Well, it's weird when you live in the same clothes this long, but you get an adult dose of humility. I mean, Chris offered me this shirt this morning, and it was like, shit, man, it's Christmas, Christ. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through this third step prayer real quick. I'm going to break it down. And the first thing I had to do when I looked at this prayer is written in King James. I don't speak King James. If I ever walk up to you and I say, how art thou today? Slap me, because I've taken leave of my senses. I don't speak in King James. I don't get it. So I have, and the book gives me permission to change the wording. Okay? But it says, you're at step three. And again, I do this step on my knees with my guys. In the book study back home, 150 people on that night, we get on our knees and we take this step individually. That's what we do. Do they all proceed into a fourth step? No. Not necessary. But we take this step together. It unifies the group. It says, we're now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to you. It doesn't say I give myself. I'm offering. You know, if I walk down to Omer and I say, here you go, and he grabs this glass of water, I'm offering it to him. He may go, no, I'm good. You got cooties. I'm not thirsty. But I offer it. So I'm offering myself to God. And what is God going to do? I want God to build with me and to do with me as he sees fit. Takes me out of the equation. Because the thing that I've built got me here. The thing I built is broken. Build with me and do with me as you see fit. And then it asks, relieve me of the bondage of self. Bondage. You know when you're real submissive? Handcuffs. That's bondage. I know where you guys are thinking. Don't go there. But if you've ever been in cuffs, if you've ever been tied down, don't go there. But if you've been in a place to where you didn't have any control, that's a bondage. And I've been in bondage at my own hand. I've done things that I really didn't want to do to God's kids and his creation. And I've done things that have placed me in horrible positions. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. I got to abandon my will. My will got me here. My will is flawed. It's broken. And then it says, take away my difficulties. What difficulties do you think they're talking about? A new way of life? It's much easier for me. If you ask me what time it is, in reality, it's 11:45. It's easier for me to say, well, it's actually 6:30. Truth doesn't come easy for me. It's easier for me. It's just so much easier for me to live that old way of life. I've been sober 22 years. And living this way of life still has its challenges for me. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them. That's kind of a promise that God is going to take them away. And through that, I got this victory to do what? So I can show others that you're going to put in my path to help them. And I'm going to show them your power. It ain't my power. I'm just a guy. I'm powerless. I covered that one back in step one. Your love, obviously, this power loves me more than anything on this planet. Because I'm a dog. I'm a sorry son of a bitch, man. I burned it all to the ground. But yet, I'm like that phoenix, man. I'm coming up out of those flames. And I didn't do it on my own. God's love and God's way of life. I don't do it perfectly. But the very first thing that I do when my eyes, as soon as I gain that first conscious thought in the morning, my sponsor has taught me, the very first thing I do is I go, good morning, God. What can I do for you today? Now, that sounds real grandiose, but here's the deal. That's my first conscious thought. If I can hook up with God right out of the gate, before I pee, before I get coffee, before I do anything, I got a better chance of getting through this deal because I got to deal with you all day. You know what I'm saying? I don't understand a damn thing you ever say in here. It's okay, though. I got a feeling that, you know, Werner's always talking about me. Isn't that kind of what you think, Chris? You know, you ever watch American football? You ever watch American football? Any of you guys? Yeah? No? Well, they do a thing called the huddle in between plays. And when they're all huddled up down there, I'm convinced they're talking about me in that damn huddle. So, the prayer ends by saying, may I do your will always. And if you notice, there is no amen at the end of this. Amen means an end to something. This is a beginning of a brand new way of life. You're about to embark on something that's foreign. It's unknown, but you now, you're not doing it by yourself. You've invited divine power in to guide you through this, to comfort you. And it says that, it's funny, Bill's such a manipulator. You would think he would put this at the beginning before you do all this, right? It says, We thought well before taking this step. This is after you've done it, right? Making sure we were ready. Oops. That we could at last abandon ourselves, that old self, utterly to God. And to wind this up, my experience, it says here that we found it desirable to take this with another person, an understanding person, such as your wife or spiritual advisor. When this step came down for me, I'm still homeless. And I had about 30 days, and I'm still sleeping around under bridges and in boxes and abandoned cars. And on this particular night, an old using friend of mine had allowed me to stay in her home. And she had a day bed. Now, she's still using. I mean, we were freebasing back in the day. And she was allowing me to stay on this day bed for one night. Nobody would allow me to stay there longer than that. And I'm laying on this day bed, and this is a place where her cats and dogs slept, and it had hair and smell of animal urine and dirt. But it was soft. It wasn't a cardboard box. And so it's like nirvana for me. But I'm laying there, and I thought, wow, this is what it's come to. I'm an A&A now. But I'm still homeless. This still sucks. And I remember this old biker named Billy Fisher back in my first couple of weeks. He asked me to go back home and read page 60 through 63. Well, I had the book, but when I took it down from the headboard and I opened it, it went, crack. It had never been opened. And I read this and I went, whoa, wow. And I never did the step. Never done any of the work. But that particular night, I'm fumbling around in the dark because, as you're going to hear tonight, I actually came in through Cocaine Anonymous, a very young fellowship. It was less than 3 years old, and they were feeling their way around trying to figure out how to do this work, whereas the pioneers in AA, I wasn't hanging around them because I caught alcoholism from the alcoholics. I didn't walk in here an alcoholic. I was a hip, slick, and cool drug addict that was homeless. But... But this chick is laying back in her bed, and when I'm laying on this day bed that night, and I'm thinking, shit, man, this is it. This is the end of the road, and this is as good as it's going to get. And I remembered old Billy Fisher talking about this particular part of the book, and I didn't have the book with me. It's me in my stinking clothes, and I rolled out of that day bed, and I recited this to the best of my ability. I pulled from the sick-ass head of mine the wording as best I could. And what happened that night, it wasn't a flashlight, but that night I knew that an effect had taken place in my life, and it was a good one. I knew that I never had to be alone again. And from that night to this day, my life has done this. I'm continuing to grow. I'm never going to rise above human. I still do those self-will things, and they place me in a position for you to harm me. But it all stemmed from right here. So that night I did that step. And I finally got my own place. And I was driving up a highway north of Atlanta one night. I was all alone in the car. I had a spiritual awakening. It was gradual over time. But that night I'm driving up I-85 north. And there was a knowledge. No burning bush. Nobody was talking. There wasn't anybody in the car. I wasn't crazy. But there was this knowledge that just came into my consciousness. And the knowledge was that I never, ever, ever had to be alone again. Whether I'm with you in this room, or whether I'm laying alone in my bed at home, or riding down the road on my motorcycle, I'm never alone. Because, you see, I made a third step decision that invited God in. And through that decision process, God has had his arms around me and guided me through this work. And all the obstacles I thought that would have killed a normal human being, which I knew I was, I came through the other side better than I went in. Does that make sense to you? I can't. But through your guidance and a power greater than us, I can live and be free today. Thanks for your time.